Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
This is Anastasia.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and before we get started today, I realized that we never really had a last episode of the year. There was a scheduling snafu, and in the last episode of the year, I really did want to thank everyone who makes In the Drink possible, from our producers, Jack Inslee and Jory Morales, to Aaron Fairbanks, who keeps everything going together at the station, all of heritageradionetwork.org and Heritage Foods, and certainly our sponsor, Michter's. We could certainly not do any of this without everyone here. And obviously, thanks to so much to Roberta's for lending us this space and the beautiful smell of the wood-burning fireplace and pizza oven that I get to enjoy every Wednesday morning. It is awesome. Anyway, thank you so much, and I'm sorry we never got to do this at the end of the year. I don't get to thank everyone who makes the show possible often enough. So thanks, guys. All right, so I'm super excited today. I have a friend, a super nice guy, one of the top guys in the Italian wine world, in the restaurant world here in New York, Mr. Jeff Kellogg. He is the wine director at Maialino Restaurant. We had his predecessor on the show as well, Liz Nicholson, who worked with us briefly. And Jeff has been doing really exciting things at Maialino. And you can imagine a place, if you haven't been, that is a Danny Meyer restaurant. So incredible warmth and hospitality, absolutely delicious Italian food by Nick Ander, the chef, and real wine chops by one of the top Italian wine experts, top wine experts in the city, a man who got the Rudd Scholarship when he passed his advanced sommelier exam. He's worked on both coasts up in Napa and Michelin starred Red and Latoque, worked with Raj Parr at RN74. And then about a year and a little bit more than that ago, moved here to New York. New York is lucky to have Jeff Kellogg here. So welcome to In the Drink. Excited to have you on the show.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
Well, did I mess any of that up? Did I get it all?
No, I'm impressed. I can tell you read the bio.
I read the bio a few times.
Somebody went to Maialino's website.
it's a great website. Very complete bio. And you see how many people who are really at the top of the game just work in that one restaurant. It's pretty impressive and awesome.
Well, I think throughout USHG, really, I mean, the collection of talent is incredible. So much fun to work with.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, so we'd like to start our show with the best wine that we've had in the last week. There is a wine that I've heard sommeliers talk about quite a bit. I was actually introduced to this wine at, not by a sommelier, but by a local wine shop. Slope Cellar is my favorite wine shop in my neighborhood in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It is the Damour Chablis, and I've been holding on to it. I brought it down to D.C. this past weekend to visit my friend Alex Zink, who's going to be opening up a restaurant in Washington, D.C. With Jeremiah Langhorne, who's the chef from McGrady's. They're opening up a restaurant in D.C. Over the summer at some point, so look out for it. But Damour Chablis is something that very hard to find. You see, I think it's one of those wines that maybe sommeliers will like not list because it's so hard to find. I've only heard about it, and it was delicious. A 2012, just their AOC Chablis, and it had like a roundness, a richness, a weight, but without any, certainly no oak on it, but it felt like it had seen some oxygen, and it was just really intensely mineral and delicious. And I loved it. So hopefully I've given you some time to think about the wine that you've had in this past week, Jeff, that you've really liked. Have you had Demore Chablis?
I haven't, but thanks for making it harder to get now by, by telling everybody how great that was. Well, all the Toms appreciate that. Listing it. Chablis is definitely one of those categories I miss, only working with Italian wine as well. I would say for a wine that I didn't get to enjoy personally, just got to taste because a guest ordered it, 67 Giuseppe Rinaldi Barolo was pretty incredible. And it was one of those old Barolos that sometimes you're afraid when you, obviously you decant it for sediment. And sometimes you're afraid like, oh, you need to drink this like first hour because you don't know if it's going to fade. Opposite with this wine. You needed an hour to let it open up and then it was just incredible. Actually, some other Psalms came in and ordered the bottle off the list. I would say for one I got to enjoy myself. Speaking of wines that are really hard to get and you can barely get any, the Eau Chardonnay from Emmanuel Brochet, who I think is making incredible champagnes. That Le Mont Benoit is just so chuggable, so delicious. I love that that champagne.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, so I guess you bring up quite a few things that I'd like to talk about with you. Number one, your wine list features some super old Nebbiolo, some super old Barolo at really, I think, pretty reasonable prices, at least especially when you can compare them to other great wine areas such as Burgundy, which is the easiest to compare. And then also that decanting in an old Barolo. I have also found that for some reason I found that in my personal experience, decanting old Barbaresco, they tend to fall off much more easily than Barolo. But I had a similar experience with 67 Bartolo Mascarello, and I did a tasting at New York Vintners down in Tribeca, and they had decanted that hours before, and I got there, and I was like, no, that's the prize wine of the night, and it's just going to fall apart. And someone there had had it before, and they're like, this wine opens up in the decanter, and it was totally the case. What was first of all, tell us about some of the old Nebbiolo that you have on your list. How do you find it? It's just amazing. And what's the experience like drinking a Barolo from the 50s or 60s? It's in my life, I've only maybe one tiny small handful of times had a Barolo from the 60s.
Sure. You know, it was for me, the reason that those prices are so low and there's so many old Barolos. From the minute that I got to New York, Emily and our goal was to make it the best place to drink Italian wine in New York, which is really hard to do. There's some incredible Italian lists out there. And so all you can do is kind of tailor the list to what you like to drink and the prices you would want to pay. Obviously, you would prefer that they were free, but so I really like that category being much less expensive than any other list. It's definitely hard to source, and to be honest with you, you kind of have to be ready to pounce when a seller becomes available where the storage was great and they made great selections. And sometimes you just have to buy the whole seller at once.
Right.
So fortunate to work with a company where you can pull things off like that.
Yes, because you have amazing amounts of offsite storage and a big amount of budget, I imagine, to have a list like that. So those are nice things to play with.
Not a big enough budget, but
it never
still
is.
Still pretty fortunate.
It never, ever, ever is. And it's just amazing that in Barolo in the 50s and 60s, there were really only a small handful of producers who were actually bottling wine. So I'm sure at this point, you probably have worked with most of them. Who are some of the reliable producers that you go to? Is it still the great names like Giuseppe Rinaldi and Giacomo Quinterno that maybe we know, and Bartolo Mascarello? Are there some other names, maybe some wines that you don't see, that maybe they stopped making wine and you can find some older stuff like that?
Very much so. In fact, I've been surprised because when you're around the wine business for a while, you think you know all the producers, and it's not the case at all. Like, once you actually start to learn stuff, you realize that you know nothing. And so you definitely, both Mascarellos and Quinterno, Giuseppe Rinaldi especially, I mean, those are obviously ones that you can count on when they're old, just like you can count on the young stuff being incredible. But definitely discovered some producers that I had never heard of. Accamasso is one where those wines from the 70s are pretty incredible. Franco Fiorina is another one that I had no idea existed, but those wines are pretty great from the 70s and even before. Schiavenza. Actually, the old Borgognos are shockingly good. I found some back to 27, And they age
incredibly. Get out of here. Back to 27. So Borgogna is a producer that will release their wines very late. And you might have, actually, I think, released them at several times. So you might have a bottle of 67 Borgogna that was released in 75, and then one that was released in 85, one that was released in 2010 or something like that. And they're somewhat controversial because of their practice of removing the cork, perhaps decanting the wine and topping off with, I think... I'm not sure. Is it current vintage or is it the same vintage of wine?
My understanding was that it was more similar to Pepe and that it was the same vintage.
Same vintage.
But you know how these stories go. Maybe that is the case most of the time. Maybe sometimes it's current. You really never know. But, I mean, all you can do is... I mean, that's why the information about who it came from and did they buy it original release? When did they buy it? Mm-hmm. Where did it come from? You know, but also, luckily, with the internet... And being in New York, the closeness with importers and distributors, so often you can take a picture of the label, email it to the winery, and they'll be able to tell you most of the time what they did to the wine or when it was released. Or they might not tell the truth 100% of the time, but a lot of times they do.
Yeah, and that's a good point because a lot of times those wines aren't labeled until they're shipped, so they'll know
exactly.
They'll know what it is based on what the label. What the label looks like. I want to back it up just a little bit. We've had quite a few people on the show who have either worked with Rajpar or are Rajpar. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your experience at RN74. What do you take away from working with Rajpar, and how do you apply that to your beverage program? What did you learn? How much do you miss Burgundy?
A lot. As much as I love Italian wine, I definitely do not drink very much at home. It's mostly Burgundy at the house. Working with Raj was incredible. He lived upstairs from RN when I was there, and so he would pop down all the time. It's not as if he was working the floor on a regular basis anymore, unfortunately. So often when you have somebody like Raj, who people talk about so glowingly, and he's awesome and amazing, you think that probably not going to live up to the hype, right? But wasn't the case at all. He's an even better blind taster than people say he is.
There's just these legendary. I mean, you hear just like impossible wines that Raj has been able to blind taste. It's like legend, and he really does it.
He really does.
It's amazing.
Like from the producers that he knows best, down to the vintage, of course, but down to the vineyard. He just picks up the little minute details that each vineyard produces that nobody else catches.
Absolutely amazing. So, your experience with Raj was certainly rooted in French wine there. When did your interest in Italian wine occur? Was it you got offered this job and you're like, I better study up? Or was there something that happened before that got you really interested in Italian wine?
I definitely had to study when I took this job. you mentioned Liz before, to be able to run a program of the level that Liz had created, I definitely had to study because there's also so many producers that only New York gets that you're unfamiliar with. But I would say that love for Italy probably started especially when I opened up Redwood in Yountville.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Shearer was the wine director there who is brilliant. He's awesome and so much fun. So I learned a lot from him. Also got to see him build a half California, half Italian list and kind of learn from him and see what he did and learn about producers and regions and, you know, things that you had never learned from books, etc.
Are there any producers that California only gets that you can't get here in New York that you're like, oh, I wish I could get them? Or I like to think that we have everything here, but I know that's not the case.
I can't think of a situation where there's somebody that we had in California that you can't get in New York. But I will say you definitely get bigger allocations in California.
Yes.
There's so much competition in New York that anyone that comes out, you're just getting like three bottles because there's, 500 more Jeff Kellogg's that are trying to get the same wine.
Yeah, that's a good point. We had Jeff Porter on the show last week, and they're opening up a Babbo up in Boston, and he said the same thing about Boston. He said that he's able to get much more of the wines he wants the most, or the allocated wines at least, in Boston, because there's just not as much competition.
Exactly. I had that same conversation with Jeff. And I told him that when I start seeing those massive allocations on its wine list, I'm telling on him for bringing those wines down from Boston.
Yes. Oh. Now another one, I think maybe, you know, two of the best places to drink Italian wine. And you highlighted this before. I think Maialino's so great, not only because it's not because it's a comprehensive list, but because there are so many great values for just truly exciting and hard to find wines. Nebbiolo is really my favorite grape. I think that you probably have a certain passion for that as well. You have a Barolo bar. Tell us about that. How does that work?
So every year during truffle season, we always kind of highlight four or five times a year different regions to pour by the glass, whether it's, you know, Highland Campania or Sicily. But every year we always go back to the Barolo bar for truffle season. So it's a different theme every year. Last year we were showing off vintages. So we had a span of 40 years and there was 12 different wines from 12 different vintages that kind of rotated. This year we decided to highlight some of the different communes of Barolo. So the five major communes plus Verduno, and we just have two producers from each of them. But we tried to show off the very best producers. So Giuseppe Rinaldi's by the glass, both Mascarellos, Capilano, etc. But also with a little bit of vintage depth. It's not, none of it is current release. So it's not like you have to, not that drinking 2010s would be bad, but it's, we're talking about 99s and 01s, and it's so much fun to work with and get those wines in people's glasses and pair and pour flights. It's amazing, especially during truffle season.
Amazing. You're going to find me at your bar tonight with that. I mean, those are all my favorite. How could you not just jump at the opportunity to taste those? And you're pouring those by the glass. You have a wine preservation system.
We have the Enomatic behind the bar. We had the same thing in RN74. So mm-hmm. It was fortunate and lucky to come to Maialino and have that same system there to work with.
Just absolutely incredible. So people can get a half glass even, because I imagine a glass of Giuseppe Rinaldi 99 is going to be a pretty expensive situation.
Yeah, obviously it's not cheap, but at the same, it's 55, 56 a glass, something like that. So in the grand scheme of things, really cheap for that wine.
Yes,
but yeah,
it really
obviously
is.
You can, and that's one of the fun things. I mean, if doing half glasses of Giuseppe Rinaldi next to Bartolo Mascarello next to Giuseppe Mascarello, doing those three half glasses,
oh,
it's pretty fun to do side by side by side.
Dude, that's too exciting. I think I might feel overwhelmed. That's so exciting. And then are people really understanding? Are you having a conversation about the different communes with guests? Are people into that? I mean, I know sommeliers who have a hard time grasping the differences between the different communes, especially since there are so many Barolo producers who make wine in a wide range of styles.
Sure. So much of it is actually producer driven sometimes than it is the commune. But I mean, you know this show. A lot of guests want to ask questions and learn about and taste. Oh, I want to taste something from Limora next to something from Serra Lunga then. Some guests want that, and they want to be educated. Some guests just want a delicious glass of Barolo, and they don't want to be... So you don't talk about it with them. You just get them a delicious glass. Other people you can talk to and, you know, show a couple different Barolos next to each other and give them that experience, too. So just like anything else, it's about tailoring it to the guests, what they're there for and what they want their experience to be.
And that's what makes you a great sommelier, not just someone who can memorize and regurgitate facts. Because I think that you know, everyone at Maialino and certainly USHG really embodies that, being able to tailor the experience to the guests. You know, we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more of Jeff Kellogg from Maialino shortly.
Today's break song is called Chillin.Bat from Rectech. This is In the Drink.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we're back with Jeff Kellogg, the wine director of Maialino Restaurant, one of my favorites here in New York City in the Gramercy area. Jeff, I wanted to talk with you about some of the wines that you're excited about, maybe the non-classic Italian wines that you're excited about. We shared a New York Times panel on Pinot Grigio together, and I think we both approach that cautiously, but I think as someone who's certainly interested in learning more about knowledge, education in wine, and kind of seeking out new and different things, where in Italy are you excited about? Have you tasted anything that is new to you recently that's getting you excited?
That's a great question, Joe. Actually, I'm going to turn that question around on you after I'm done, but like in terms of regions that aren't classic, I just had this conversation that I think Aglianico in general is kind of maybe the next one that people are going to start collecting, realize how great it is. Hopefully the wines get a little bit better as some investment comes in there. I feel as if Sicily is maybe, and I know that's kind of a played out answer a little bit, but I think in Etna, the whites are perhaps better than the reds.
Wow.
I think there's some really delicious, I think Terranari's white is delicious. Actually, the Grillo from Marco de Bertola, I know that's not an Etna, but that's a white that I just put on by the glass just because I think it's so incredibly delicious.
It's so good. The Integer, that one, or the...
No, it's a different. It's Grappolo di Grillo.
Okay, yeah. I think that area is kind of ripe for the future of Sicilian wine. The northwestern area, they have a long history of wine production, but certainly not wine quality. But there is some elevation there, especially around Erice, and there's some very windy areas as well, which can cool down a vineyard site, certainly in the way that high elevation would, and certainly make it less prone to different kinds of molds and mildews and stuff like that. So I think that northwestern area, Marco de Bartoli for sure leading the charge, the historic estate, but high quality and looking towards the future. And they have an interesting grape that they grow up. I love Grillo from that area, but also Pericone for a red grape can have some interesting results. I think there's more work to be done with that grape.
Yeah, it'll be fun to see some other people make some still dry wines and see if the wines are as good as those wines are,
yes,
or if that's just a really great producer that has some good vineyards.
Yes, I think so. And then I've actually found some wines from Puglia that I've been excited about. It's generally not been a region that I've been drawn to in terms of their wines. I think that some of the wines on the flatter land and maybe a little further south can be just a little kind of ripe and clunky, but up in the north, kind of abutting Basilicata, there's some hillside vineyards, and they get some elevation, and you can actually have some wines that have the ripe fruit that you associate with Puglia, but without the really heavy, burdensome alcohol. And so the Primitivo up in that area produces like Guttarolo, and Dresner has another producer that's up there that I think is really delicious.
Did you find those ones when you were traveling there, or when you're in New York having distributors bringing those wines?
The latter, actually. It's funny, when I travel in Italy, I'm not sure if this is the same for you. I guess our guests tend to think that we find wines while traveling, and I just tend to visit the wineries that I already like and know and learn more about them and try to deepen my knowledge, because it's so much work to get there, so much effort to get there, so much time that, and I really don't like to visit more than two or three producers in a day. You want to give them enough time and really learn about what they're doing, that if I'm not feeling the wines, I don't want to be rude and leave. So I just try to go visit the ones that I like. When on your travels, you try to find new producers, go to the same, mix it up.
I might make some appointments at a place that I don't know, mm-hmm. if somebody I think is really smart recommends it.
Yes.
But no, right. Especially because we get so little vacation time as SOMs, that you want to take advantage and hit all your favorite producers, see what's going on, see why those wines are great, see the vineyards, etc. So no, it's not as if I'm an importer who gets there weeks ahead of time to kind of scope the land and ask questions and ask around. We just don't have the time to do that, unfortunately.
Don't have the time. And it's also about the relationship with the grower. You want to further build that relationship and see them.
I think the only time that happens in my case is when you're visiting a producer that you know well, that you've become friends with, and then they, hey, you need to go check out these wines from my friend. Let's drive down there.
Yes.
So you can taste these. That's probably the one exception where you find somebody who's maybe poorly imported to the States or not imported into the States.
Yes, yes, that has certainly happened to me as well. And then they tend to always be good, right? They're like, if you like the producer, generally, if they're like, you got to check out my friend, the wines tend to be pretty tasty.
Yeah, and that's such a great question to ask your favorite producers is, who are you excited about in your neighborhood? But Joe, I'm impressed that with as much as you have going on, when that distributor reaches out about Puglia wines, you still take the appointment. That's why you're the best, because you don't turn down it. You taste everything.
Well, you know, I sold wine for a year for Vinifera, and it is one of the toughest jobs, I think, in the wine industry. It's very humbling. People can be disrespectful to their reps. Maybe I didn't deserve any respect. I was very young, and I certainly was super green. But I know it's a tough job that doesn't really get any respect. As wine buyers, you have a lot more power, and I think it's a really nice thing to be a wine buyer. And everyone, producers want to suck up to you, and they may not suck up to you, but they're really motivated to have a good relationship with you. As someone who's selling wine, you need the buyers a lot more than the buyers need the sellers. So it's really such a hustle. I try to have a good relationship. That being said, I put very strict parameters around the relationship, which I think is healthy for them as well. I try to really outline which kind of wines that I want people to bring, and it tends to just be indigenous grapes made by independent producers who like grow the grapes themselves and bottle wine, and if they can make them in a more natural way, that's generally better and looked, you know, for us. But and no Pinot Grigio Prosecco on our list. And so I think that within that, you know, people tend to and then after 7.5 years, I've worked with enough of the distributors that they know what I want, and I've kind of weeded out the distributors that I don't want to work with anymore.
Sure. Yeah, I know that I would be terrible at that job, so I do have respect for what they do, because I couldn't do it.
It is a tough job running around the city in the cold, hot, rain, whatever. And if someone doesn't
carrying
show
a
up
bag
to
of point, wine.
Carrying a bag of wine up and down the subway, rush hour traffic and all the stuff.
It's one of the beautiful, and they get turned down more than they hear the word yes.
Yes.
Which one of the great things about our job is when there's a guest who makes a reservation, comes into your restaurant and sits down, they're obviously going to buy something. It's the best sales job in the world, because it's not even sales. All you have to do is tailor the experience to what they want, show them a great time.
Yes.
Because they're there to eat and drink, so everybody leaves in a great mood, and it's the best sales job you can possibly have.
It's so true. Yeah, they have an open wallet as they come in, and it's really what the way that we talk to our team about it is that you're not selling, you're just offering the options that we already have available. So don't look at it as selling. Just say, like, we have all these options. Whichever is best for you, we're happy to abide by. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And how have you found the transition to New York, the New York small A community, the distributors? What's different between the West Coast and New York City?
There's a lot more sommeliers in New York. I'm really impressed by how many great somms there are. I mean, I knew that obviously it's New York, but it's incredible the talent that's in New York right now. It's humbling. Every time you go to a tasting, you're like, there's 40 somms here, and I'm probably the least smart in the room. Like, it's
I doubt that's true.
It's so, but yeah. You know what I'm saying. It's so humbling working in New York because there's so many. There's no topic you can be the smartest in. But I feel as if I love New York. I'm having so much fun. There's so many savvy wine buyers, so many savvy guests that come in that know so much about wine that you can still turn on a new stuff because they're excited about it. And I'm fortunate. I literally got here and 3 days later I started working. So I've just been, working and just having fun and getting to it. And, the team is so great to work with, getting to learn from, John Reagan is, I mean, in a lot of ways, like working with Raj in terms of how much you can learn. But John's there every day. So, I mean, it's a constant. There's no traveling to Santa Barbara for Sandy and other, you know what I mean? So working with John's incredible because he's always there. You can always ask him questions. He always gives advice, but in no way do you have to take it, which is incredible for a company's wine director.
Yeah, I mean, it must be a great challenge for him to work with so many accomplished wine directors underneath him, you know, so many people who really do such a great job running their own programs, and he's a force in and of himself, but it just speaks to the quality of the wine, the whole wine program of USHG that you have John as well as you and Juliet and so many other greats. One thing I want to ask before we get going, I mentioned at the top of the show that you had passed your advanced sommelier with Rudd Scholarship, which is the highest score. Congratulations on that. Are you studying for the master? Is this a question that everyone asks you? You're smiling.
I'm sure you get this as in the dining. Ever since Somm came out, everybody yes. asks if you're a master sommelier when they sit down and ask for the Somm. I'm not studying now. I'm going to sit out 2015, but I do plan on sitting in 2016.
Yeah. Do you know what happens? People introduce me as a master sommelier. I'm like, no, that right. is an actual thing that you have to study for and be way more studious and smarter than I am to actually get that. And I think that it's sometimes people who don't know about what actually goes into it can throw that term around just to, you know, to say that someone is a sommelier and they're good at their job, so they must be a master sommelier. But no, it is, as that film showed, it is a very large time and financial commitment to do it. And I can imagine coming, to New York that you maybe you want to settle in a little bit before doing that and starting a new job and all of that makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the difficult thing about that exam is there's so many guys like you that are so much smarter or know so much more about wine than a lot of people who have passed that exam. Nothing's wrong with them. It's just obviously you're extremely talented. But when you're running wine programs, you don't necessarily have the time to put in all that study because it's a lot.
It's a lot of study, huh? Certainly keep us up to date if you go for it. We'll be rooting for you. But in the meantime, we'll be drinking some Barolo and other fun stuff up in Maialino. So thanks, Jeff, so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure having
you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me, Joe.
And that's Jeff Kellogg, the wine director of Maialino. Go visit them. Pretty awesome place. And thanks so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on Heritage Radio Network.org.
Thank Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.